My name is Mary Gallagher and I am an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here at the Desert Powwow. And I would like to thank Clancy for asking me, along with Shirali, for having me here, and thank the committee and all the graciousness and nice things that have been said and done for me. I'm very grateful. I've never spoken in California before, and I consider it a great honor. I also consider it to be a little intimidating, and don't ask me why, but I am naturally sensitive and shy. You know, I would say to you that at 25 years of age, when I drank my first drink, that was the first time I had any sense of comfort, any sense of being adequate, and any sense of having an ease in my life. In fact, my skin fit at 25 years of age when I took my first drink. Now, if I tell you I felt adequate, you would say, so what? Isn't that the human condition? Doesn't the human condition wander around feeling inadequate? Yeah, they do. You talk to any normal Joe, he'll tell you sometimes he feels inadequate. But the difference between him and me is that when I took a drink, it all went away. I no longer felt inadequate. I had a change of personality when I started to drink. And in the back of the big book, in Appendix 2, under Spiritual Awakening, it says that eventually we will have a change of personality. That is what defines a spiritual awakening. So AA will eventually do for me slowly what a drink used to do for me quickly. You see, when I started drinking at 25, I immediately drank on a daily basis. And I never had anyone who told me that I should not drink. But it was sort of accepted in my home. I was born in Glasgow, Scotland, and my parents were Irish. I used to think that's why I was nuts, you know. Being Irish, born in Scotland, I felt like a leprechaun in a Presbyterian church. I was born looking for magic, and there wasn't any. But you see, there was one source of magic for me. The only person in my life until I came to AA that I identified with was my old grandfather. I was brought up with my grandfather and my grandmother, because my father was at sea, and my mother wanted to live with her parents, and they had 11 children. I had 11 aunts and uncles. And we all lived together. And my grandfather taught me to read when I was 4 years old, and he was a coal miner. And he was a wonderful man, and I just loved him. But every Friday and Saturday night, my old grandfather would get washed and go to the pub, the bar. And every Friday and Saturday night, he'd come staggering down the street from one pavement to the other, you know, east to west, the way the drunk walks. And all the neighbors would be behind the curtains laughing at my hero. And my granny would, she was an untreated Al-Anon. My granny would be behind the curtain with her rolling pin and her rosary, the two staples. The two staples of the Irish household. And every Friday and Saturday night, there would be the only war that there ever was in my home. And I said, I will not drink. I will not have my family waiting with weapons for me. And every Sunday when my old grandfather, he had the black lung, and we used to take a long time to walk to chapel on a Sunday morning. And when I'd be walking with him, he'd say to me, I won't drink next weekend, Princess. I won't do it again. But see, every weekend he'd be doing it again. But he didn't mean to do it again. And I was to carry on that legacy to my own children, when I would really mean it, when I'd say, I won't drink again. Only to drink time after time after time. My family, I won't bother going to, because they were good people. They were good Roman Catholics. I don't know, they used to say that they don't know where I came from, and I don't know either. There is a strange insanity in my family, but it's a very private insanity. I have an aunt who can be sitting having a cup of tea, and all of a sudden she freezes in time. And people come and say, what happened to her? They say, she's just away. She'll soon be back. That's it. I had something that a lot of alcoholics have, although you will never hear Al-Anon give us any credit for it, and that is I had a high IQ. And the only thing a high IQ has enabled me to do is I've never completed anything I've ever started. Ever. I get bored very quickly. And because of this high IQ, I was sent to a convent to be educated by the psychopathic nuns. I know I made them psychopathic. Because I was so restless and irritable and could never, I used to grasp things very quickly, but they never knew how I got there, so they used to accuse me of cheating. And I was a bad actor, and they used to refuse to teach me. So I would be sent to sit outside the Mother Superior's office. And she said, I want you to study that thing in the wall there, and if you apply that thing to your life, then you will have everything you need to be a better human being. And I used to look at this thing in the wall, and it said, of courtesy it is much less than courage of heart or holiness, but in my walk to me it seems the grace of God is in courtesy. Now, I wanted nothing to do with courtesy to me or my fellow man. But since I have been in Alcoholics Anonymous, gradually I have learned what it is to have courtesy for my fellow man and for my fellow alcoholic. And that's a wonderful thing, because I used to hate everybody. I got thrown out of the convent at 15 for fighting. I hadn't had a drink. I started running with Irish street gangs. I don't know if you know Glasgow. It's not exactly the city of brotherly love, you know. It's a little bit like Belfast. On St. Patrick's Day, we beat up the Protestants, and on the Orange Walk Day, they beat us up, and it's a custom. And I did a lot of things that my family would never want to know I did, and I was very ashamed, and I had a lot of shame inside of me, and I also had a lot of rage. And I decided that I was going to recreate myself, and I went into nursing, and I got bored with nursing, and eventually I left. You see, I was having geographics before I drank. I had to get away from people, places, and things because people found out what I was really like, and I wasn't very nice. So eventually at 21, I decided I was going to go to London, England, and I was going to teach those turkeys down there that I wanted some of what they'd been taking off the Irish and the Scots for all those years. So I joined British Airways, and they taught me how to walk, how to talk, how to say yes, no, thank you, man, how to use my knife and fork from the outside in, how to walk properly. And on the outside, I was looking good, and I was flying all over the world, and it was wonderful. But I couldn't have a relationship. I could have sex, different story. I could not have a relationship. So I decided what I'm going to do is I'm going to get married. This is the next best thing to drinking. And you know, I love it. I used to love that feeling of love. What used to happen to me when I fell in love? It would be, him and me would be like Velcro. No. And it's a great passion, and we don't want to be with anybody else, it's just him and me. And then what happens after 6 months is thrill is gone. Thrill is gone, and I'm off looking for that ding-a-ling-a-ling someplace else. So I went to live in Kingston, Jamaica. And, you know, I want to make a point here. If there was anything external could have fixed me, Jamaica would have done it. I might have been a little crazy, but I wasn't stupid. I married a man who had money. I was embraced by the Jamaican people. I lived in a beautiful, beautiful place. I had married a man whose family were related to the old rum family in Jamaica. And after about 16 months or so, my first little boy was born, and I loved that child very deeply. But just after he was born, I thought I was going insane. I was fragmenting, is the only word I can tell you. And somebody said, have a drink, and I drank it. And I can't tell you it was the first sip, the second sip, I don't know. I just know that eventually I had the realization that that one drink was doing for me what nothing had ever done for me. It was just making me feel at ease. because it was, you know, there's a line in the big book that I love. Bill Wilson writes about, he's trying to describe the alcoholic, and he's trying to say if this man doesn't drink, he's more or less normal, except for a certain nervous disposition. Now that covers a multitude of sins. You know, I had a certain nervous disposition, but it could have been borderline psychosis. I don't know what it was. Now, when something makes you feel that good, you drink every day. And I immediately drank on a daily basis. I used to drink 151 proof rum, and it is marvelous. It is wonderful. And you know, all my life I had looked at people and they had this ease and comfort in rooms and situations where nothing seems to be of any effort. It just is easy for them. And it was also such an effort for me to mingle with people. Now I have a few rums and I am magnanimous and I can say, hi, how are you? I'm very well. How are you? And how are you? And it's wonderful. I just feel in command. And that's what alcohol did for me initially. It was a magical thing. But you see, it didn't last. I had about 4 years of drinking like that. And then, as it says in our book called Living Sober, I only ever read AA imprimatur about my illness. In the book called Living Sober, it says when the cucumber becomes a pickle. And when the cucumber becomes a pickle, you can't go back. And I know that I became very obnoxious. And people in Jamaica would call and say, Mari, I'm having a party, please don't come. And I am very sensitive, so I would go anyway. I like to say that I am the first white alcoholic Rastafarian in the history of Jamaica. The first wannabe. You see, I had shown, when my old grandfather died when I was 9 years old, I don't say that I knew that I said these words, but I looked in the coffin and I saw him lying there. And I think the thought I had was, if there is a God, screw you. And I started acting out from when he died. And I could not ever get a handle on this JC of my forefathers and this religion. I just didn't have it. But I wanted something spiritual. And I heard about the Rastas, and my husband was a very respected man, and I was allowed to go most places in the island. And I used to go and listen to some of their stories and the readings of the Old Testament, and they would always have these big baskets of sensimilia. Do you know what that is? Ganja. And I would see what they would do, and you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in Toronto right now about the drug addict and the alcoholic, and they're having battles there. And I could see the difference from there. I'm talking about the straight drug addict vis-a-vis the straight alcoholic. I'm only an alcoholic. That's all I know about is alcoholism. But I used to see them, and they would have a big spliff, and it was so big you couldn't even see their face. Right? And they would go, I just want to mellow out, man. Have a little vision. And they would lie down and meditate. That's not me. I got things to do. I got worlds to fix. I will eventually end up lying down there whether I want to or not. But that's not my choice, you see. And eventually what happened? I used to live across the road from Bob Marley on Hope Road. And he used to say, you're running and you're running and you're running away, but you can't run away from yourself. And many years later I was to see in our literature where it said, you keep trying to change people, places and things, but you never think about changing yourself. It says in the big book, the self manifested in various forms is the root of the problem. You see, everywhere I went, I took myself along, drunk and sober. You see, I was born, and I don't know why, but it's my opinion that I was born needing a personality change. I was born with some kind of soul sickness, and I don't know what it was. And I truly believe that part of my journey was to find alcohol. Like Carl Gustav Jung said to Bill Wilson when he said that the formula for the alcoholic is spiritus contra spiritum. I had to find my way to the spirit through the spirit. And that was the journey that I had to take. I left my husband and took my two little boys, their age 9 and 4, on a drunken geographic halfway around the world. Alcohol took away my children's innocence, and they never touched a drop. I never raised my hand to my children, but I am an alcoholic mother, and my children saw some terrible things. A man called and asked me to get married. That's another thing I used to do with alarm and regularity. I love to get married, but I have no follow through. None. A man said, let's get married and we'll go to Canada, and I thought, what a good idea. And we went to Canada and we ended up in Alberta. Now, I was very drunk. It must have been minus 40 when I landed in Calgary, Alberta. And I knew that I had made a serious mistake. But I'd run out of options, you see. I didn't have any more options. I am shaking so much now in the morning that I can't raise up my drink. I had started morning drinking long ago, but now I can't raise up the drink. So I know that I have a serious Valium deficiency because I'm quite bright. So I go and I get a job as a pharmaceutical rep. And don't ever say God can't drive. Because God drove me around the prairies. My territory was southern Alberta, Saskatchewan, and BC. And sometimes I'd be so blacked out, I would leave one place and come to another and don't even remember the journey. And one incident I'll tell you about there, I remember I come out of blackout, I was on the Calgary Trail, and I heard the police sirens, and they knew me by name by now. And he came and said, Mary, don't you know it's against the law to drive on rims? I had two ball tires and I was clunking along. And all they did was lock up my car with a detail bag full of prescription drugs and throw me in their car and take me home. I sent that husband, my second husband, away. And eventually I had this terrible agony where I want help and I don't know what's wrong with me. You see, I know that there's something wrong with me because I feel that I'm a little bit mad, insane. I can't identify with anybody. I cannot stop drinking, and it baffles me because I love my children, and yet poor little boys, they have nobody in Canada but me. And they come home in the day and see me lying passed out drunk. They see me bring strange men home. Oh, their life was just a nightmare, and I wanted help. And I have what you call, I don't know if any of you have suffered from this, but it's called alcoholic telephonitis. Alcoholic telephonitis is a phenomena that never attacks in a day. Alcoholic telephonitis usually approaches around midnight. When you're sitting alone with your jug and you want to call somebody and tell them how you've been screwed by the world. But you don't want to call anybody nearby because they might come. So what you do is you call other countries, you forget there's a time change, you wake them up, and when they say hello, you pass out. I have these two old aunts, my mother's sisters, and they're warriors, and they came to Calgary and told me I had early menopause and put me in detox. A wonderful thing happened to me in Calgary detox. My first brush was real alcoholics and alcoholism. I hadn't heard about AA, but in early of 1979, I was in Calgary detox. And it was just me and five Native Canadians. And they would hold my soup to me and my coffee when I was shaking too much to hold it by myself. They told me that they drank because their spirit was broken. And I realized in some way my spirit was broken too. They told me they were in to dry out so they could enjoy the summer. And I got some understanding of a brotherhood of people who have to drink. But it wasn't enough. It was a mere glimmer in my journey. When I got out of there, my family went back to Scotland and I went back to the Caribbean. This time it was going to be different. This time it was going to be different. And my husband asked, the children's father asked if he could have them for a week, and they were gone for 13 years. And I don't know how I have lived. I still have a crack in my heart when I think about it and when I feel it sometimes. And I don't know how I lived. I had my first suicide attempt, and I took 151 proof rum. My heaven had become a hell. And I took 151 proof rum and Valium, and they have a saying in Jamaica, you're hard to dead. And I think that alcoholics are hard to dead. I have people in Toronto who come to me and say, Mary, I know if I drink again, I'd be dead. I say, you wish. You wish. We don't die easy. You know, not at all. So they pumped out my stomach, and the psychiatrist the next day told me something that was extremely observant. It was quite accurate, and it was definitely relevant to my condition. The psychiatrist said to me, you mustn't do that anymore. I had an admonition. You see, they don't understand. They don't understand. My worst remember when is coming out of an old rundown hotel in Kingston with my escort of the night before. I want somebody not to have a hot, passionate night. I want somebody to while away the hours with me. To talk about the things that I know are impossible, but when we have a few drinks, all things are possible for a little while. And the only people who will stay with me are people who are like me, drunks. And him and me go into the enchanted cottage until the sun comes up. And there was an old American author called Scott Fitzgerald. He died of alcohol-related problems. And he wrote that in the dark night of the soul, it's always 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was always 3 o'clock in the morning for me. And in sobriety, it can be 3 o'clock in the morning too, if you don't have a higher power, and if you're not working on a spiritual change. At 3 o'clock in the morning is something for the alcoholic. And I'm coming out this old hotel with this man, and a car passes by with my ex-husband and his new wife and my two children. And I knew I was shaming them. I was to know much more humiliation and degradation, but that was the worst for me. I left the island, I went to Miami to drink myself to death. You see, I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not know that I was not a bad person trying to be good, but I was a sick person trying to get well. I did not know there was a God that I could find in my own understanding who eventually would forgive me for I believed I had been forgiven for the things I had done. I did not believe there was ever anything could be made of use of my life. I was in a hopeless place. I had a little money left. I had a little apartment. I'd drink, pass out, and they'd steal my furniture. I'd drink and pass out, and they'd steal my clothes. I'd drink and pass out, and they'd take that which I had to give and that which I did not have to give. I ended up selling my blood for $20 a pint and living on Skid Row at the bottom of Lincoln Road in Miami Beach. And my time from first I drank till then was like a wayward tune. It was like a beautiful melody that suddenly became a wayward tune. It just became discordant. My life became discordant. And I didn't know it was happening, and yet I was present for all of it. My family didn't know what had happened to me. They didn't know the children had gone. And something I'd never been able to talk about until recently. My father retired from sea, and when they couldn't find me or find out where the children were, he went out one morning at 4 a.m. or 2 a.m., my mother's not sure what time, because he says to her, I don't know, she's breaking my heart, I don't know where my daughter is. I was my father's only daughter. And he dropped dead in the street. He dropped dead in the street at the same time I was on the street. And I didn't know that. And my father was not a drinker. My grandfather was a drunk. So my aunt came and, I started drinking. I was about 110, 112 pounds. I had long jet black hair. I was a lean, mean, bronze sex machine, 15 years, I'm 160 odd pounds. I can hardly, my eyes are so swollen they can't open, my hair is matted. I can only wear a size 10 and a half flip-flop. because my feet are so swollen. And they were made out of that rubber that had to be cut out my feet, because they had embedded themselves into my feet. And if there's anybody new here, and you say that can happen to me, if you be an alcoholic of my type, and you really don't know there's any hope, and you can't find people that you will talk to, you will end up where I ended up, because that's just the illness of alcoholism. It will take you there, and you don't want to go there, it's the dragon. And my family came, and eventually I went back to Calgary, Alberta, and met a man I'd known for a long time. He said he was going to help me, and he was a good man, and he started putting, the first time I tried to kill him, he took me to the psychiatrist. And they admitted me, and the second time I attacked him with a knife, they put me in for a long time. And they always misdiagnosed me when I was in the mental institutions and the psychiatric wards, because they think that because I'm Irish, I'm a little wingy anyway. And they're right. But not certifiably so. And I would never tell them the truth. I just wanted to. I love being institutionalized because I'm safe from the greatest enemy I have. I love it. You know, I can get 22 hours of sleep, and I can get all the medication I want, and I love it, and it's wonderful. And the only thing you ever have to worry about is becoming a fire hazard when you drop your cigarette butts in your paper slippers. We all know what that's like. You know, it just goes on. And the last time I was there, I was taken by the police, and I was in a lot of trouble. And I was kept in there for a long time. And eventually when they let me out, the psychiatrist called me and said, we're trying to keep you out of prison. And I've written a psychiatric report, because he'd been looking after me for a few years. And he let me read the psychiatric report, and it said, chronic alcoholic, abnormal personality, and depressive. And those are all true. And I was to find out they were all true when I read the big book. Because in the big book it says, the thought that we are like normal people or presently may be has to be smashed. What does that mean? Abnormal? That's me. See, I get identification there. I have had no drugs, no prescription medication since the dry date, 10th of August 1984. But the most important thing for me was that a chronic alcoholic was the first thing he had on there. The prosecuting attorney wanted to put me away, and the defense said, Your Honor, this woman has suffered tragic social circumstances. And that's what I was. That defined my life till I came to you. I was a tragic social circumstance until I came to AA. One night I picked up the phone and I phoned AA, and a man called Stan C. came, who had 29 years sobriety. This is in Edmonton. Now, I had been to AA meetings before, but I was full of all kind of drugs, Valium, Librium, Lithium, whatever. So I didn't know what went on. But I had enough that I could pick up the phone, and Stan came and he spoke to me for a few hours, and he said to me, I think you're one of us, and nobody had ever said that to me before. And I said, Stan, I know I'm terminally unique, you see. And I said, Stan, I know I'm an alky, but I'm also nuts. I got a psychiatric report that says I'm nuts. He says, Mary, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is like 12 adjustable wrenches for any nut that comes through the door. And those are words of wisdom. My dry date today is the 10th of August 1984. I had one slip, and that was the 9th of August. On the 9th of August 1984, some people from AA came and they took me to a meeting. I was in very bad shape. They tell me I was shaking so much, strangers were waving back at me. You know how bad that is. They made me laugh. They made me laugh. That night, a little gal called Linda spent the night with me. And the next day, she said, I'm going to leave, you know, because you're a loser. And I only stick with winners in Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I go, I'm going to ask you to kneel down and say the third step prayer. I said to her, I don't kneel for nothing. And then something said, think of your children's eyes. And I held her hand and I knelt down and I repeated the third step prayer after her. And from that moment to this, I have had no desire for a drink. Now, to me, that's one of two things, and I don't know which one it was, and it doesn't much matter. But either it was an involuntary surrender because I'd had enough, or it was some, I don't know, unmerited gift of grace. I don't know which one, but I've had no desire for a drink. Now, does that mean I'm well? I don't think so. I mean, I was a dingbat before I drank, and I had personality disorders before I drank. So now I'm going to have to work on my personality. And that's what I did. And AA in Edmonton, they trained me very well. And Bill Wilson was my higher power until I could find a God of my own understanding. And what they would do for me in AA in Edmonton was they would come and give me the key and let me open up the meeting room. They'd tell me to go and buy coffee and I'd bring back the change. Not a big deal for some, but for me, yes. And I was responsible, and I loved it, and I had a sponsor. I've always believed in strong sponsorship, because when I come to AA, my life is a mess. I've lost everything of value. I don't know anything. So therefore, I will have to submit myself to somebody who I know knows better than me. And that is the willingness that I have. I'll go to any lengths to do that. There was an old man out west called Ernie, and he used to say, "Mari, we usually stay in no relationships for a year, but for you it's two." Because you have a propensity for getting married. And I said, "That's okay, I'm not interested, Ernie." Now, Bill Wilson was my higher power, as I said, for 10 months. There was an arrogance in that because I wanted the main man that wrote the book. And also, I could really relate to everything that Bill wrote. But the old timer said, "You better find a God of your own understanding." That's what this deal is about. And you know, the messenger comes in various shapes and sizes. One day I was down and I heard this old woman from the Northwest Territory, and she was the most spiritual woman I'd ever heard. And she was singing about her God. And yet she was saying things like, "As a drunken woman, I never went to bed with an ugly man, but I sure woke up with a few." She says, "But I don't do it anymore, because I am a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous." And I went up to her and I said, "Who is this God you have, Helen? I'm looking for a God." She said, "Mary, my God's called Harold." I said, "Harold?" I was expecting something like Zeus. She said, "You know that prayer, 'Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.'" She was pulling my leg, so. I believe the God of my understanding brought me to AA so I could find the God of my understanding. And of course, I can never understand my God, because God is anything the intellect is not. But I have a loving presence in my life today that I am so sure of. I don't have any religion. This is my cathedral of the spirit. Bill Wilson said that when we come into these rooms, that we don't own any of them, then what happens is that the floor becomes paved by the 12 steps, and that the walls become enclosed by the 12 traditions, and that the hand of service is a spiral reaching towards God. This is my cathedral of the spirit, and I'm so grateful to have it. I went to Toronto because I heard that my son was going to be going to school there. I went to the phone two people in AA. They came and met my plane. I wasn't a year sober. They took me to the workstations. I got a little job. I got an apartment. I got very active in AA and saw my son and was able to make some amends before he went back to Jamaica. And it was wonderful. And now I'm 2 years sober. And I say this because if there's any new people here about relationships, they can be very devastating. You can learn a lot. But when I was 2 years sober, I just knew that I was ready, because I was looking good. And one Sunday morning, I was 2 years sober, and I go to the Dawnwood group, my Sunday morning group in Toronto, and I look down the table and I see him. And he's looking back at me with those eyes. And I just know that this is the one. No, keep an open mind. I'm not about to be attracting any spiritual giant. I know there's people at 2 years sobriety who can have good, healthy relationships. That wasn't me. And when I'm that sick, I'm going to attract my insides on the outside, and so is he. And here's what happens when you're both sick in AA. We still went to a lot of meetings, but we'd have one of our peacock feathers, and we'd strut our stuff. And someone would ask me to read how it works, and my eyes would flit across the crowded room. And I just knew that God was shining down on me and him. And we would wander off under the circle and the triangle. my sponsor said, don't get married, you're an emotional retard. I knew she was jealous. So John and me eloped. And here's what happens in the close intimacy of marriage. In the close intimacy of marriage, when you haven't had a personality change, one by one the peacock feathers start dropping off. And in the end, all you have is the same two old turkeys sitting staring at one another. And that's how it was for me and John. I eventually had to leave that marriage at 5 years, and I had to go and live at the YWCA because I didn't want to drink, but we were psychologically destroying each other. And I still was very active in AA. It's easy to go someplace. To go to the Y when you're 5 years sober is not an easy thing. I know we shouldn't have ego, but I had some, but it was where I had to be. I surrendered to the God of my understanding one more time, and I said, I don't know what's good for me, God, you do. And I got a little job, and then I got a little apartment, and then I got an even better paying job, and eventually I got a call from Jamaica. He said my sons were acting up, and I decided I would go back to Jamaica to live for a couple of years. And I went back to Jamaica when I was about 7, 8 years sober, and I went to live with my old ex-mother-in-law down there. My sponsor said, make amends to the island, and I did. I got very active in AA down there, and I started working with the poor people and doing other creative work that I loved. And that's when I first came face to face with Clancy, and Clancy was of great help to me because there's not a lot of long-term sobriety. You see, I had sought out Bill Wilson, knowing Bill was dead. And I wanted to meet somebody else that I admired living, and at that time, and still today, it was Clancy. And Clancy helped me, and he used to phone me, and he used to send me tapes, and he was a great help to me when I was alone down there. And eventually I came back to Canada, and now this is what I want to tell you about amends. God will give me amends to do in many different forms. When I came back to Canada in 1993, I signed a separation agreement with that man I married. 10 days later, I still had a key for his apartment and I couldn't get him on the phone. I had that intuitive thought that something was wrong. I went and had his door kicked down and found him lying by the side of his bed. He'd had a massive stroke. He'd been lying there for 3 nights and 2 days. He couldn't speak and he couldn't understand the spoken word. And he was paralyzed on one side. And I said, if he gets where I can take him home, I will. And I took him home for 3 years. And I looked after him. He wasn't able to talk. But, you know, it was the most spiritual thing I've ever done for a man. And it certainly helped me to grow. And I loved it. And about 2 years ago, he was very, very bad, and he had to go into chronic care. And he's still alive, and I go and see him all the time. But I had never, ever been... My mother and father were both dead when I got sober. They never knew if I'd ever draw a sober breath. So I have to make amends, and I was not a good wife to the men I married. I didn't know how to be. It doesn't matter what they were like, I'm talking about me. So I got this chance for John, and then my two sons came back to me. And we had 2 years together until I went nuts, and we went about their business. 2 years ago, my eldest son got married out in Nanaimo, which is kind of just up from LA, Western Canada, you know. And when I flew out there to attend the wedding, his hall was at a room I had spoken at an AA conference a few months before, and he didn't know that. I think coincidence is God's way of staying anonymous, because I felt comfortable. His father flew up from Jamaica with his stepmother, and him and me walked my son down the aisle. Now this is a man that 20 years ago I'd hired 2 little Jamaican gunmen to shoot. But I was too drunk to finish this, thank God. And he's looking at me and he's saying, my God, you look well. And I said, you were almost toast, but you don't know that. Last year, my youngest son, born Jamaican, got married in a kilt in a Ukrainian Orthodox church. That's my boy. And he danced with me to a tune called Mama. Now, am I well? Let me tell you how well I am. I'm doing a lot better than I ever did. I'm a lot gentler, I'm a lot kinder. I love my AA. This has given me such a sense of purpose. I have a wonderful relationship with the God in my understanding. I have a good relationship with my children. But it can fall in a minute. You know, when my first grandchild was being born last November, I was hanging by the phone all day because I couldn't get out there. I had a conference the next day and I couldn't be there for the birth. And it was a long, long labor, and I had lit a little candle, and I was talking to the God of my understanding. And about midnight, my son called me and said, "Mom, I'm holding your first grandchild in my arms." I said, "That's wonderful. Thank you, son. What a miracle, AA and God." I said, "And what is the little girl's name?" He said, "Nina Mary." Now, her mother's name is Nina. I'm getting second billing. In 1 minute, I said, "Nina Mary." I said, "Let me tell you, for 57 years, my name has been Mary Teresa. Nobody ever called me Teresa. So I guess that Mary will go the way of the placenta down the toilet." After praying all day, anyway, I flew out in December and made amends. 3 weeks ago, I spent the whole day outside the birthing room, and my youngest son presented me with a little granddaughter called Maya. I shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be getting these things, these joys. I certainly don't deserve them. But I am so very grateful, and I will try to be worthy. I will certainly try to be worthy. It's a wonderful journey. This is the greatest life. I know I had a soul sickness, and I am so grateful to Dr. Bob and Bill for what they gave us in 1935. Something happened. I am certainly not the miracle, but I am part of the miracle. And I don't want Alcoholics Anonymous to change. I want it to be just the way it is in case my children come here. And I will always do whatever I am asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank you for being here for me. Thank you for the wonderful AA that emanates from you to us. Thank you, Clancy, so much. Thank you, Shirali. And I'll finish with what Bill Wilson said. Bill Wilson said, "Alcoholics Anonymous is not a success story. Rather, it is the Alcoholics Anonymous is not a success story. Rather, it is a colossal failure turned to usefulness by the divine alchemy of a loving God." And thank you.